Good afternoon. It is 1 o'clock. I call the meeting of the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 8th, 2026, and a quorum is present. Representative Burkle, would you like to move the minutes from March 25th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Burkle moves the March 25th minutes. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first item on the agenda is an informational hearing on House File 2103. This bill is in possession of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee, so we will not be taking action on the bill or the author's amendment. The language we will be discussing today is in the H2103DE1 amendment. Chair Anderson, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Harder. Members, yeah, good afternoon, and welcome back, I guess, to the Ag Committee after a well-deserved respite. We are working off a DE3 amendment, and the reason this is in the possession of the Energy Committee is it's a spending request, fairly substantial request, but with each new iteration of the bill, the spending request has decreased. Earlier it was $10 million, then down to $9 million, and the request in this particular bill today before you is $8 million, broken down into four different categories, each of which will be explained to you. We have a number of testifiers, I should say. But the bill to me is kind of interesting and exciting because it offers a new way for Minnesota, the upper Midwest, to locally produce nitrogen fertilizer, which is a key component of growing corn, or really any crop, but corn especially here in Minnesota. And with what's been happening in the Middle East, we've seen not only the price increase, but the availability is going to be a concern as well this spring. Hopeful that that Strait of Hormuz is opening up as we speak, and the ships are moving, but it's going to take a while at that rate even to get product to the Gulf and then upstream as well, either through the river or by rail. So this is a very timely look at a way that we can produce fertilizer here in Minnesota. I have a couple of testifiers, Madam Chair, and would like to have you hear their testimony now, if we could.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. We have six testifiers today. It's a little bit different than what your agenda shows. The agenda was printed before. We had all the testifiers' names. So we will start with Tristan Wilmes from CFS. Please come to the testifiers' table, state your name, and then please proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Tristan Wilmes, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tristan Wilmes. I have the honor of serving as Vice President of Agronomy for Central Farm Service, a farmer-owned cooperative serving about 4,500 members, owners, across southern Minnesota and northern Iowa. I'm in strong support of House File 2103 with the A5 amendment. I want to start with a simple point. Farmers don't just have a price problem, they have a supply and certainty problems as well. Over the past several years, we've seen ammonia prices swing dramatically, more than 300%. That volatility is driven by anything happening here in Minnesota, it's driven by global natural gas markets, geopolitical instability, and supply chain disruptions. And we're seeing that play out right now. As recent reporting has shown, global events directly impact fertilizer supply and pricing. Because a significant portion of the world's fertilizer moves through vulnerable and unpredictable global trade routes, the latest conflict has skyrocketed fertilizer prices in the U.S. despite relatively little change at the Henry Hub natural gas prices for that same period. For example, as of April 6, terminal prices for ammonia in the Corn Belt were $750 a ton on February 26 and are now $1,000 per ton. Imagine your own home mortgage or car payment jumping in price like this. For farmers, unpredictable costs and unpredictable supply of one of their most important and necessary annual crop inputs creates massive financial risk. At CFS, we believe we can do better. That's why we're working with Talus Ag, Clean Counts, and other project partners to bring commercial-scale, locally produced ammonia to Minnesota. And most importantly, the project enables something that we, the state of Minnesota, have never had before, a 10-year contract that guarantees both price and supply of anhydrous ammonia. That kind of certainty changes everything. It allows our members to plan ahead, it reduces financial risk, and brings real stability to one of our largest input costs in farming. As outlined in the proposal, this project is expected to generate more than $62 million in direct affordability benefits over that 10-year period for rural farm families. We forecast that farmers will benefit at a rate of roughly $25 an acre across 250,000 acres. Multiply that by 10 years, and that's the $62 million in savings. Now, I want to be clear about something else. We do have skin in the game. Central Farm Service has committed our own capital into this project, including storage, handling, and infrastructure needed to deliver this product to our members. We're making these investments because we believe in this model and because our farmers need it. This is not a pilot. This is not theoretical. This is a cooperative stepping forward to build a more reliable supply chain for our members. And with your support, this project will supply ammonia to cover a significant portion, if not all, of our annual needs. The Renewable Development Account gives Minnesota a unique opportunity to support projects that deliver real benefits to ratepayers and rural communities. This proposal does exactly that. It leverages private investment, it strengthens rural economies, it improves how we use Minnesota energy resources, and most importantly, it delivers long-term affordability, not just short-term relief. Chair, members, Minnesota farmers should not be dependent on global markets for one of their most essential inputs. We have the ability to produce ammonia here, we have the demand here, and now we have a model that works at a commercial scale. This project is about affordability, it's about certainty, and it's about taking control of our supply chain. Cooperatively, in service to our members, I respectfully ask for your support of House File 2103. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And next up we have Tristan, is it pronounced Pites?
Pites? Yes.
Pites, all right, from Talus Ag. Go ahead, state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tristan Pites, President at Talus Ag.
Stay close to the mic.
Yeah. Greetings, Chair, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Good afternoon. And thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the Minnesota Made Ammonia Act, House File 2103. My name is Tristan Pites. I'm the President of Talus Ag. We are an agriculture, technology, and energy infrastructure company focused on producing ammonia fertilizer locally using air, water, and electricity at or near the point of use. A fascinating book, and one we've made required reading for new members of our team, The Alchemy of Air, tells the story of Fritz Haber in 1909 first synthesizing ammonia with hydrogen derived from water using electricity. He partnered with Bosch to industrialize and scale up the process, resulting in the Haber-Bosch ammonia synthesis process. Today, all ammonia used in Minnesota is imported and produced in large centralized facilities similar to those designed by Bosch. The result is that farmers are exposed to global price volatility and supply disruptions. The conflict in Iran is just the latest. Talus Ag is offering a different model. We have developed modular, distributed ammonia production systems that can be deployed locally and operate flexibly. We are already deploying this technology today. Talus has deployed and commissioned three demonstration systems producing ammonia on three continents, here in the U.S., as well as in Spain and Kenya. And the first commercial-scale system is under construction in Eagle Grove, Iowa. To be clear, the Iowa systems were made possible by significantly lower power and electrical infrastructure costs available at those locations. Our U.S. systems leverage the federal 45V fertilizer and fuels tax credit. To benefit farmers, this federal tax credit was included in the One Big Beautiful Bill by congressional delegations throughout the Corn Belt, Texas, and West Virginia. Here in Minnesota, we are proposing to develop a project in Blue Earth that would bring approximately 10,000 to 14,000 tons per year of locally produced low-cost ammonia to the state. It's roughly 5% of the state's annual anhydrous ammonia use of approximately 200,000 tons, but most importantly, it's a start. This project has been thoughtfully designed. With support from the renewable development account, we expect to move forward with financing this year and begin deployment in 2027 and have ammonia ready for application in 2028. This is not a pilot. It is a commercial scale project designed to serve real farmers through our partnership with Central Farm Service and Clean Counts. Our approach is designed to deliver value in three ways. First, affordability and stability. Local production reduces exposure to global markets and lowers logistics costs. Second, reliability. Farmers gain access to fertilizer produced closer to where it is needed. And third, economic opportunity. These systems create local infrastructure and support rural communities. Talos is also a public benefit corporation. We are committed to transparency with audited financials and third-party verification requirements tied to the federal tax credits. Madam Chair, members and members, this legislation helps bring a proven, scalable solution to Minnesota, one that strengthens agriculture, improves supply certainty, and supports rural economies while also serving as a replicable model to help address curtailed wind power in the region. We respectfully ask for your support of House File 2103. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimony. Next on the list is Rob Davis from Clean Counts. And then following that is Rachel Stecky, Executive Director, Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum. Please state your name and then begin with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Davis. I'm the Chief Growth Officer for Clean Counts, a nonprofit clean energy registry that verifies energy production across North America. For nearly 20 years, our role has been to provide trusted, auditable data that allows energy markets to function with confidence. Today, we support markets for electricity and fuels, such as RNG and biomethane from biodigesters, as well as landfills. With this project, we will extend that same infrastructure to ammonia. Members, you've heard about the core challenge. Farmers are facing extreme price volatility in fertilizers, and it's driven by global markets outside of Minnesota's control. This proposal offers something new, local production, backed by a 10-year fixed price contract that will guarantee both price and supply. This creates certainty. For this model to scale, we also need trust and transparency. As part of this project, we will further develop our capabilities to track ammonia production, similar to how RNG tracking and renewable energy certificate tracking works today. In practical terms, this means that each unit of ammonia can be measured and tracked, and farmers, cooperative, and buyers can make credible, auditable claims regarding the CI score of a given crop, backed up by trusted, auditable records. This matters because markets only grow when participants trust in the data. Without that trust, investment slows and value is lost. With it, markets expand and costs come down. The second benefit of this proposal is to address curtailed wind power in southern Minnesota. Minnesota counties that host wind turbines need stable, not uncertain, energy production tax revenue. Local production of ammonia has been identified as a way to use wind power during times when there is not capacity on the transmission system. This helps ensure productive use of assets that have already been built and helps stabilize tax revenue for rural counties. Madam Chair, members, this is a great year to act on affordability benefits, and this bill does exactly that. As Central Farm Service said, $62 million of affordability benefits over 10 years. We respectfully ask for your support of House File 2103, the Minnesota Made Ammonia Act. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that. Next we have Rachel Stecky. Please state your name and then begin your testimony. Thank you.
questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Anderson, Chair Hansen, and committee members. My name is Rachel Stuckey, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum. I'm pleased to be here today, though, on behalf of the newly formed Minnesota Made Ammonia Coalition, or MMAC, which brings together organizations across industries with the goal of identifying the policy and practical pathways needed to establish a local ammonia economy in Minnesota. And additional information about the coalition could be found in the letter in your packets. Minnesota imports nearly 1 million tons of ammonia every year, with almost all of it produced out of state. And even in normal times, transporting ammonia to Minnesota adds costs that are passed on to farmers and consumers, and we're seeing in real time the impacts of what happens when supply chains become vulnerable. We have the opportunity to address this and do so in a way that connects multiple pieces of Minnesota's economy. And that's what's really so exciting about this opportunity. Local ammonia production isn't only solving one problem. It's another step towards establishing a circular economy in Minnesota. Wind energy that can't get onto the grid is being curtailed across greater Minnesota, which costs counties real tax revenue. And that energy can be used to produce ammonia, a product used across agriculture, mining, steelmaking, manufacturing, shipping, energy, and other industries. And the economic value of all of that stays right here in Minnesota. It means price certainty for farmers, stronger and cleaner supply chains for industries that don't have many other options, and once proven at commercial scale, a model designed to replicate wherever energy resources, grid congestion, and demand align. And this bill isn't just about getting the first facility off the ground. It invests in the research and analysis to scale this across the state. In addition to the wide variety of industries and organizations supportive of locally made ammonia, this bill has bipartisan support from Metro and Greater Minnesota legislators across both bodies, reflecting the breadth of industries and areas of the state this investment stands to benefit. The MMAC respectfully asks for your support of House File 2103 as amended, and we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for that testimony. Next on the list is Ann, I believe it's pronounced Schwagel. Did I get that correct?
You did.
Awesome. Thank you. Please state your name and then begin your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Co-chairs Anderson and Hansen, community members. For the record, my name is Ann Schwagel, and I am a farmer in Big Stone County. We run a diversified grain operation where we raise corn, soybeans, winter camelina, and wheat. I'm also honored to serve as Vice President of Minnesota Farmers Union. I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts on the importance of Minnesota expanding its leadership in developing the green ammonia industry. The regional production of green ammonia fertilizer will reduce the use of fossil fuels in agriculture while creating economic opportunities for family farmers in Minnesota. It is a priority for Farmers Union. We hosted a green ammonia summit back in December of 24 at the U of M West Rock, where a bunch of research is currently being done on some of the foundational research on green ammonia. The production of nitrogen fertilizer contributes significantly to total greenhouse gas emissions. Green fertilizer alone has the potential to reduce the carbon intensity of corn production by over a third. The ability to reduce carbon intensity with a drop-in replacement for a traditionally produced nitrogen fertilizer may allow Minnesota farmers to access price premiums and new market channels while reducing emissions in the agricultural sector. We also see significant opportunity for farmers to have a stake in the production of fertilizer through cooperative ownership of this key agricultural input. Recent spikes in fertilizer costs due to the shutdown of shipping through the Strait of Hormuz underscores the need for regional production and local ownership. Even before this recent activity, we know that the fertilizer market is heavily concentrated, with just four multinational corporations controlling 75% of the production in the United States and sales. Investing in locally produced green fertilizer will create economic resilience for farmers and the state of Minnesota by creating jobs, boosting cooperative ownership, and providing more choices for farmers. I want to thank Chair Anderson for his leadership on this topic, and Farmers Union looks forward to working with this committee on developing this industry in a way that works for Minnesota's farmers. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And next up we have Darren Broughton. Did I pronounce that right? Please state your name and then begin your testimony. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Darren Broughton, Executive Director of Minnesota AgriGrowth. I am excited to be here today and express my strong support of House File 2103 because it is the shot in the arm that Minnesota's agriculture and food economy needs right now. Members, you've heard this before. Minnesota's ag and food economy is mired in a great recession for the last 2+ years. Whether it's inflation or extreme weather, a changing climate, major animal health events, turmoil in our global markets, disruptions in our supply chains, all of these have created the perfect storm for farmers, food processors, and the local businesses that serve them. The proposed facility can help our economy mitigate that future economic and political uncertainty while thrusting our state onto the global stage. For years, national and state leaders have discussed investing in domestic green ammonia. But while we talk, the rest of the world has action. In China, they have built the world's largest green ammonia facility, and they are exporting affordable and cleaner fertilizer across the Pacific Rim. India, which is the world's second largest user or consumer of fertilizer, they've invested billions of dollars in developing new green ammonia facilities to support fertilizer. And India is mandating that 37% of the steel produced in India comes from green ammonia energy. Last year, Minnesota AgriGrowth convened leaders across the farm, food, logistics, supply, and research sectors to start laying the groundwork for a stronger Minnesota agriculture and food economy by 2040. One of those common themes that we heard was that we need world-class processing facilities, which are essential for our growth. The proposal in Blue Earth is one such facility. I am excited to be here again today to support 2103 because it is the shot in the arm we need. It is a priority for Minnesota, and I believe that it's the way for us to put our food and agriculture economy back on track. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak to the amendment language? Seeing none. Members, please note that there are letters of support for the bill in your meeting materials. Next up, are there questions from members of the committee? And first up is Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Anderson, for bringing this bill forward. Some really, really interesting things, and I like a lot of what I am hearing to be above board before I get into some more critical questions. Generally speaking, I am not a fan of direct appropriations to non-publicly accountable entities, which gets me flack from both sides of the aisle. And so, you know, I do have a couple of questions just to queue up, Madam Chair, here surrounding the rationale behind maybe some of the accountability mechanisms and the rationale behind the particular entities that these appropriations are written to. So I guess the first question I have is, Madam Chair, is what's the rationale behind naming grant recipients legislatively rather than opening up these various subsections to competitive grant models where different entities could compete and offer us the best product and the best deal? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Gottfried. A legitimate question, and this bill was put together with the parties that have a track record working in this area. Clean Counts has been doing this, and it really gets complicated, these RINs and all of these things that are used to verify the production of the biofuels and such. And the language came to me, but my sense is that these entities were picked because of their history and track record of being involved in this particular type of work. And the last piece was to the University of Minnesota, and they have done so much work at the Morris Research and Experiment Center. They've been doing this on a research level for years at Morris, and part of this funding would go to also help them with continued research to, the process, the Haber-Bosch process, has been around for years and years and years, and it's basically the same process we've used for 100 years. But there is research being undertaken to improve that, use a different process, But again, to answer your question, I think these were picked to show their expertise in the areas, and that's why they were chosen.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer, Chair Anderson. No, that makes sense. And on the University of Minnesota, that is a publicly accountable entity, so I have less heartburn over that. My next question, what I do have heartburn over is granting specifically to named nonprofits, and then what I believe is a for-profit entity in Talus Ag without any sort of RFP or anything like that. That, to me, doesn't feel like good business. So just to name my thoughts there. My next question really relates to some of the accountability mechanisms that are within this particular bill. I'm looking at lines of the DE amendment 1.9 through 1.15. Looks like paragraph B applies to everything within this DE amendment, and then paragraph C applies only to clean counts. Maybe this is a question from the commissioner, but I'm just curious how these particular accountability mechanisms compare to others accountability mechanisms for grants that are administered by the Department of Agriculture. If maybe somebody from the department could come up and answer that.
I think they're searching. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Andrea Vobley. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. If these dollars were to come to the Department of Agriculture, we would do our typical grant administration process. So we would do what is required by OGM, Office of Grants Management at the Department of Administration. So we would do pre-risk assessments. We would require progress reports. We do all of our things on a reimbursement basis, but we would follow the normal protocols involved in grant processing for state dollars. And I think Mr. Davis can speak more specifically to the difference between clean counts and Talus Ag.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Member, yes, exactly. The qualifying paragraph referenced to clean counts is because we are the entity that issues certificates, whereas Talus's business is to produce the ammonia for their their 10-year offtake partner, CFS. So the requirement to report on the number of certificates issued in the state of Minnesota falls to us.
Thank you. Representative Gottfried.
Understood. Thank you for those answers, and thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is my last question, but I just, before I quick make a comment, back to the commissioners of the Department of Agriculture, if for whatever reason any entity that was receiving one of these grants did not meet those standards, is it within your power, if they are named legislatively to receive this grant, is it within your power to say, no, that's actually not appropriate, given what we have found with these pre-risk assessments?
Thank you. Go ahead, Andrea.
Madam Chair and Representative Godfrey, that is correct. Yes, so we would have the authority to not issue those dollars if it was not meeting the requirements of the state.
Representative Godfrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I appreciate that. That does help me kind of navigate this. As I said, I think there's some interesting ideas here. I understand that expertise lies where expertise lies within, you know, private industry and private nonprofits. So I do understand that sometimes we're a little shoehorned into what entities we can grant dollars to and expect the efficacy of the program that we're trying to design. At the same time, I would just like to put a public plug on the public record right now for a continued adoption of competitive grant processes within all departments across our state government. I think it is a better, more accountable process for us to be following, whether that's in the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Environment, or you know, Health and Human Services. So appreciate the discussion today, and I will yield back to the chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gottfried. Next up, we have Representative Gander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Co-Chair Anderson, for bringing this bill. I think it's a pretty exciting opportunity for the whole ag community. Just a couple of questions that have been rolling around in my mind as you guys have testified on this. Number one, how long does this technology last? In other words, it's all built out. How long will this thing run with just basic maintenance? 10 year, 20, 30, 40 years? What's the lifespan of this machinery and technology that we'll be bringing in?
All right, thank you, Representative Gander. Who will be answering that question?
Madam Chair, I will. Tristan Pites from Talisag.
Sorry?
Yes, your question, if I heard it correctly, was the life of the system?
Yes.
Madam Chair. Yes, thank you for your question. So at a minimum, it's 10 years. The components themselves are rated for decades. And should modules, other components, particularly in the electrolysis of water, become commercially available, economically competitive, and industrially proven, we can absolutely swap out that part of the stack, if you will. Anything we can do to increase production at a lower cost, make the system more competitive in terms of the price of the product, we will do. That's our mission. And so, you know, it can work for decades.
Thank you. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other question. When it's up and running, fully built, roughly how many people will be needed to run the facility? How many jobs will be sustained then over the decades? Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah.
Thank you. And who would know the answer to that question? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you for your question. So each system, and there will be two in Blue Earth, you know, can produce 20 tons per day. And so there are skilled maintenance technicians, engineers, and operators. In terms of the number of full-time employees that the Blue Earth Project will support, you know, at the low end, I would estimate that to be 6. But likely more than that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good.
All right. Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question was answered earlier, but I just want to comment. We kind of had a book report on consolidation in agriculture a while back, and the alchemy of air came up. I don't know who mentioned it, one of the testifiers, but I'd recommend to the members of the committee that if you get a chance this summer and you've got a reading list, you should read The Alchemy of Air about the Haber-Bosch process and the whole concept of that technology. And I just want to thank Representative Anderson and the folks here. Whether or not this is the right funding mechanism, as Representative Gottfried brought up, that's questionable. But the process and the fact that large-scale agriculture and what it does technologically to bring this stuff to the forefront, it's amazing, and it just shows the progressive nature of our farmers right now. And I just want to thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a few questions. One's on history, another on business, and then finally on science. History, so this is the renewable development account, and my understanding, if my memory is correct, this was the fund that was set up as part of the deal for putting casks of nuclear waste next to a tribal reservation. So the renewable development account is a fee on ratepayers for Xcel for putting nuclear waste in the Mississippi River Valley next to a tribal reservation. So the ratepayers, Xcel ratepayers, you know, we're supposed to get benefits of renewable development, you know, in energy. You know, I don't want to go back to 30 years ago, but I would think it would have been a hard leap to think that they would be saying that this fund would be used, the ratepayers of Xcel would be, their funds would be used for fertilizer. They might have referenced another type of fertilizer if that was the case. So how is this applicable to use the renewable development fund, which is paid for by the Xcel ratepayers, to produce fertilizer? Everything I've heard today has been about the benefit to farmers and fertilizer, but none to the ratepayers of Xcel who would be paying the bill.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The RDA, as it stands today, has a little over $50 million in it, and the purpose is to financially make projects, I would say such as this, feasible, projects that promote clean energy, clean fuel, clean, in this case, fertilizer. But I think one of the testifiers can comment to that as well, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, let's pick one of them.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Chair Hansen, with the RDA, yes, it is funded by ratepayers. And Blue Earth Light and Water, they partner with Xcel. So it is Xcel ratepayers benefiting from this as well. And so this type of project, though, is also especially the exact type of project that the RDA, you know, in the past has funded and is intended to fund with new innovations and with this, you know, not new technology as far as the process goes, but these distributed sizes and bringing it to the commercial market here in the state. So, thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Follow up. So let's say we did this. Let's say we invested the RDA money in and it goes to private entities. And, you know, I have sympathy for CFS. I do want to say to CFS that you have great staff. I called last week to double check some numbers they were very prompt and beneficial. So, but we have a monopoly. We have four entities, and the trend in agriculture is to bigger and bigger and bigger. So what if the big sees this as a competition and we've invested public money or ratepayer money and 5 or 10 years down the line, they buy up these companies? Is there a clawback provision for the public investment into these companies? Is there a way to recover the dollars that if there was a sale if we publicly invested into these firms?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Chair, and Chair Hansen, you're way down the road on this. We are trying to cobble together funding to get this project off the ground, and this is a strong cooperative, and for them to make this leap of faith as well to invest a lot of their own equity into this project, I think speaks well to the future of this. I was going to ask the co-op, Tristan here, to comment on their investment in terms of storage. You know, this fertilizer is used for maybe a month in the spring and a little bit of side dressing in the summertime, yet they're going to be producing this fertilizer 24/7, 365. You have to have a whole lot of storage. And we're talking tanks that can handle this product. So, Madam Chair, if I could ask the CFS agronomy manager again to comment on what their co-op is going to be doing in terms of their own local private investment, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that. Tristan Wilmus, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you, Senator Anderson. We, as an industry, I would say a norm is like maybe 10% of what we use in a year we can store. We're fortunate, predecessors for me, invested a little more into storage, but to put it in perspective, like new storage now on anhydrous ammonia runs about $4,000 a ton. We would need to add to have enough storage to use what the Talos plants put out. We would have to invest into about between 5,000 and 6,000 tons of storage. So a significant investment that we're looking at making over the next couple of years, just to start building into that, having that ability to be able to take all that product when we need it. Because, like he said, we 75% of what we use in the year is done middle October, end of October to the end of November, and then we'll use a little bit in the spring and a little bit of side dress in the summertime, and that plant's got to run, so we have to have a place to go with that product to keep it running.
Thank you for that. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And back on production, and I'm just following up on Representative Burkle with the consolidation of the market with the Strait of Hormuz closing. and the price jumping, it seems like probably nationally we need a windfall profits or anti-price fixing type of thing when they're jerking the price that much. And regardless of what we do, if you have these large operators do that. But to get to the science on this, so the Haber-Bosch system, am I correct that most of our natural gas is not coming through the Strait of Hormuz, but it's coming from North Dakota and Canada? Is that correct? Or where does the natural gas come from that is being used? Okay. And where does the anhydrous come from if it's being processed?
All right. And who has the answer to that question?
Madam Chair, I'm happy to address that question.
Thank you.
Tristan Pites from Talus. yes, Member Hansen, thank you for your question. Approximately, as was stated earlier, about 80% of ammonia production in the United States is controlled by four companies. 70% of that is produced in Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. There is a plant in Beulah, North Dakota, but they won't deliver more than 250 miles. 95% of ammonia plants in the United States use natural gas as their feedstock for hydrogen. There's one plant that in Oklahoma that uses petroleum needle coke. And so the vast majority is fed with natural gas. And actually, what happens when natural gas spikes in some of these regions with a polar vortex is these ammonia plants, they shut down and sell off their gas contracts. And so they are optimizing for profit.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then so you need air and water and
electricity.
Electricity and some steel a little bit, right? And you need some, you've got to provide that hydrogen atom that's coming from where without the natural gas and you have the electricity coming from the windmills, you've got heat being produced, you've got water being used. What's the water use? What is that element that makes it work for a windmill? And then what are those uses if you have to have a lot of water to cool things down?
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Yes, go please.
Okay. Thank you, Member Hansen. So at a high level, it's approximately 11 megawatt hours of electricity per ton of ammonia produced. It's approximately 900 gallons of water per ton of ammonia produced. About half of that is used in electrolysis, so we run a bunch of electricity through the water, split the water molecule. We collect the hydrogen. The oxygen is vented, and so those are the inputs. The remainder of the water is used for cooling. We recirculate that, and so that's how you get to the sort of the mass balance of air in, water in, electricity in, ammonia and oxygen out. Does that fully answer? Okay, thank you.
Representative Hansen.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And anhydrous ammonia is very volatile, probably the most dangerous fertilizer that people can be using. It has that immediate impact of burning people if they're exposed to it. And I appreciated the cost estimates because you've got to build in the safety provisions for that. And that would require permits, correct? And so back to your question or comment, Representative Anderson, we often hear work on permits, on getting things permitted, getting them started. We have to move quickly. We need the funding. But we don't think about what happens if we have to take them apart, if we have to take them down, if we have to, if we deal with an accident, we deal with something that's very volatile. And so I think that's a question here. Again, when we put public money into something, what are the consequences and the protection not only for the public, but the people who need, if things break down, if things go bad, if things walk away, you know, how do we protect that investment and the environment and the people around it?
Was that a question? No. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, there's a lot of good-sized projects that have received some state funding. I think our heating system here at the Capitol Complex is powered largely by combustion downtown. And accidents can happen, but knock on wood, they haven't yet. And we hope these things keep going. And we don't build things with the thought that they're going to implode. I'm sure there's going to have to be a lot of insurance coverage with a process like this that does involve combustible material. And there's got to be coverage, and I would sure that the company could comment on that, but we're dealing with things that can be dangerous.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. So the reason why we work with farmer cooperatives, ag retail distributors, such as Central Farm Service, is they have the capability, the safety track record, the training, the safe handling procedures, the equipment, and to safely handle an ammonia offtake contract. We fully understand that this is a hazardous material. It needs to be treated with respect. And so safety is Talos' number one value. It's something that we take extremely seriously and choose our partners carefully. We are very confident in CFS' ability to safely handle the ammonia that we will be producing. The project site itself is in an industrial zone that it's rated for or permitted for production of anhydrous ammonia. And so that project and the site itself will be designed and developed in partnership with Central Farm Service, certainly to optimize for the safe handling and distribution to CFS growers, which CFS will exclusively handle.
Representative Hansen. Right. Representative Frederick.
thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Anderson. I am a supporter of green ammonia as much as we can for various reasons. Things that we can do to try to reduce costs for farmers, I think we should do. And when we make choices of where to invest, it matters. The more that we can invest in Minnesota-owned and operated businesses, I think just as an entire legislature, the better, right? Because we know that if we invest a dollar into a local business, they may pay their employee with it, that employee goes to the next local business, right? And those dollars stay in our community, which should stay in our state as much as possible. I mean, I think that that's the general goal. I hadn't heard of Talos Ag. So seeing it called out in statute as Representative Godfrey kind of questioned made me kind of look a little more. And what I found, and maybe the information that I found is incorrect, but what I found was that they were primarily, as an organization, funded back in 2023 through private equity. And so if, as a legislature, we are being asked to specifically designate $4 million to a company that was funded and created, well, not necessarily created, but funded through private equity, then I immediately assume that those dollars, any profit that they're making, is going to be funded right back to those private equity ventures to enrich their own pockets. And so I guess this is just more of a statement that I would say that, in general, the goal of the bill, reducing costs for farmers, and trying to develop business within the state, I'm a fan of, but that specific provision by calling out a direct appropriation, which we as a legislature, even in this committee, last year put significant effort into not doing that by having it be a competitive grant process. I think that would be my biggest concern with this amendment. And so I hope that comes off not as me being trying to opposed to the whole bill, because it's not. I agree with the goal of what we can do to try to get more green ammonia. I'm supportive of it. ways to reduce costs for farmers, I'm supportive of. But that specific provision, at least for me, is very concerning. Thank you.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative, I hear that. But again, I will go back to the what I said earlier about expertise in the field. And I was at that conference at Morris that was referenced here back in 2024. And at that time, I believe Talus was doing some research size projects in Iowa. And now they're expanding to commercial scale projects. And it's not something you can call up your local five and dime and order an anhydrous ammonia plant. It takes a great deal of skill set and experience. And the people that put the bill together and brought it to me are confident that Talus is maybe one of the few companies in the country that could do a project of this size and this scope of being commercial. And, you know, the idea of putting something like this out for public bidding, I guess it could be done. I'm not so sure how many bids you would get, and I don't think you'd get a Minnesota company, that's just my opinion, that would have the level of expertise to take on a project of this size and scope. So I think it's just something that if we want to move ahead with a project like this and be among the leaders in this country of doing this, I think we have to put our trust in the people that put these kinds of projects together, that they're the ones in the best position to do this, and go with them. But if it's a wish of this committee, well, this is informational anyway, but to fund this in another way and do competitive bidding, I guess it can be done, but I think we'd be pushing this back quite a ways by doing that.
Representative Frederick, any further? All right, last on the list is Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe this is a question more for the agency, please. And so as the agency comes up, I think, you know, just going back to the point made around protecting the public interest and if this was so in the future, and I think, you know, Chair Anderson, you mentioned that, you know, that's in the future, so why should we, you know, worry about that for right now? And so I think to the agency right now, I know that, you know, in the capital investment world, we on the front end have, you know, grant agreements, and we make sure that in the grant agreement that the state interest is first in line should there ever be a sales. And so can you tell us, do OGM policy have that in place that should this appropriation goes forward and, you know, the production facilities were to be sold, are the state, is the state going to be in position to retrieve our, you know, $4 million back, or what does our policy currently, how do we deal with that?
Sharon, Ms. Powell?
Madam Chair and Representative Lee, I would have to double check to know for sure. I'm not sure exactly what the policy says on that. I believe there is some mechanism, but I don't know exactly where that is or what it says, but I'm happy to follow up with you.
Representative Lee?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, Commissioner. I think it would be great if you could share that with the committee just on, you know, if we were to move forward with this, what would be the OGM policy that applies to all of these grants and their requirements, and also just how do we protect public interest? And thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Excellent point, Chair Lee. And we're calling on the Department of Ag here, but a lot of this also falls on the Department of Commerce that are dealing with a couple aspects of this. So we'd have to, kind of go back and look and see how that would be done. Yes, you're correct that the state has to have their interests protected. I would fully agree with that. And it wouldn't fall solely on the Department of Ag, but also on Commerce.
Representative Lee, any further? All right. All right, Chair Anderson, do you have any concluding remarks? Oh, yeah.
Can I just, Madam? Sure. On the, if it was sold, we have a 10-year agreement that would follow with the business. If another business followed, CFS would still be the offtake partner, whoever purchased that going forward.
All right, thank you for that. Chair Anderson, do you have any concluding remarks?
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. A lot of good discussion, a lot of good points raised by my colleagues. I appreciate that. And again, informational hearing. We're looking for funding. This bill may be heard next week in energy. I'm hopeful of that. But I think it's, if nothing else, it's a good lesson that progress is being made to lower production costs, make them more reliable, and these new techniques on a commercial scale are available, and we can go ahead and use those today and start thinking about these types of things. And you know, a lot of these federal programs are based on carbon scores, and the lower your carbon score, the better. And you know, lowering the score from commercial nitrogen to green nitrogen would be a huge boost to Minnesota farmers in lowering their carbon score so they can qualify for 45V was mentioned. There's a 45Z credit as well, and would really position Minnesota farmers to fare some of these economic ups and downs and commodity cycles much, much better. So with that, Madam Chair, I thank the members for hearing this today. And again, thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. That concludes the informational hearing. Next up is Representative Heintzman with House File 4508. Representative Nelson, would you like to move House File 4508 for Representative Heintzman?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 4508 before the committee.
Representative Nelson moves that House File 4508 be put before the committee. Representative Heintzman, thank you and welcome to the committee, and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. It appears that we now have a blackout. Really straightforward bill, House File 4508, would allow the importation of elk from other states into Minnesota. The elk industry in Minnesota has been struggling, and this would allow them another option to help with the breeding of elk here in Minnesota. I have a couple testifiers with, and I know that DNR is also going to want to weigh in at some point. And Madam Chair, if I could turn it over to my testifier, that'd be great.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Please, for the first testifier, please state your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
I'm Brenda Hartkopf, representing the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association. Madam Chair, Chair Hansen, Representative Heintzman, and members of the committee. We want to thank Representative Heintzman for authoring House File 4508 and for the opportunity to testify today. In 2023, that legislative session brought major changes to Minnesota's farm servant industry, including a ban on importing animals from any state or province with a CWD detection in the past 5 years. With CWD now present in at least 36 U.S. states and 5 Canadian provinces, this has effectively closed the border to elk importation and eliminated nearly all options for sourcing new breeding stock except for an in-state breeder. This has created increasing challenges for elk breeders working to maintain and improve their herd genetics, especially for retaining high-quality herd sires. A herd sire contributes roughly 50% of the genetics in each calf crop and plays a major role in an operation's success. While artificial insemination can introduce new bloodlines, the average success rate is around 65%, which makes a high-quality backup bull essential to the profitability of every operation. Premium genetics on both the bull and cow side increase both the volume and value of all the products that we produce, from meat, antler dog chews, to velvet supplements and breeding stock. Severely limiting breeding options will have long-term negative impacts on both the diversity and quality of elk produced in Minnesota. The legislature has already recognized similar difficult impacts in other sectors. In 2024, the Minnesota legislature relax importation requirements for hunters bringing in whole cervid heads from other states where CWD may or may not be prevalent due to hardships experienced by taxidermists. Hunters may now bring whole cervid heads into Minnesota if they are taken to a licensed taxidermist within 48 hours of entering the state. In 2025, lawmakers created a pathway for accredited zoos to import live cervidae with appropriate safeguards after strict import limits began to interfere with their ability to manage healthy, sustainable herds. Elk are more naturally resistant to CWD than other cervid species. We know this from our own experience in Minnesota and from studies in wild populations. After losing 30% of our breeders since 2023, allowing importation under the oversight of the Board of Animal Health would provide meaningful relief to those who remain committed to the industry. While there has not been a case of CWD in Minnesota farmed elk in 17 years, the elk industry remains committed to working with the board to control the spread of CWD. With thoughtful policy that balances disease prevention and economic viability, we have an opportunity here to support responsible producers and ensure the Minnesota elk industry remains a sustainable part of Minnesota's agriculture future. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier, please state your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Pat Rivers, the Deputy Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife at the Minnesota DNR. We do not support House File 4508 to allow the importation of elk from outside of Minnesota. At this time, there is no validated live test for CWD or chronic wasting disease that would allow us to ensure that those animals coming in from another state are CWD free. Federal CWD herd certification programs continue to fail to prevent the spread of CWD. A recent example from December 2024 is from Madison County, Idaho. There was a farm there that imported elk from Alberta that later tested positive for the disease. The Idaho Elk Facility met the requirements for international movements of animals and was approved to import those animals. No one suspected those animals of having CWD. Additional captive elk herds detections have occurred in Pennsylvania, Indiana, Utah, Colorado, all within the last year. CWD has been detected, as you've heard, in wild cervids in 36 states and 4 Canadian provinces, and in captive cervids in 19 states and 4 Canadian provinces. Unfortunately, the axiom absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. I got that screwed up. But we need a validated live test.
Can't be fooled again.
Finally, this will mention that the cost of responding to a new CWD detection in captive cervid herds will exceed $500,000 in testing of wild deer surveillance for the Minnesota DNR. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify for or against House File 4508? All right, seeing none. Are there questions from members for the testifiers or the bill author? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Heinzman, I think there's one thing maybe you and I can agree on, and that's the years have slipped by. Well, we have a live test that's been developed at the University of Minnesota that we heard federal validation was right around the corner in 22, 23, 24, 25, and now we're at 26. And you know, we've invested as the state of Minnesota a great deal of money in, I believe, high quality people who have resulted in a test that's reproducible in a live manner. But it's not recognized by the federal government. And I don't anticipate any speed. I guess speed is the best word. Maybe captured is another word. But I don't expect much to come in terms of validating that test from the federal government. So, and maybe this is Representative Anderson too, I think there's something we could work on here, which is broader than this particular issue with the captive elk. And that is, okay, we've invested five, maybe 10 over the years in the live test. How do we get that where maybe we do a state validation or we provide authority for a third party agency to validate that test so that it has meaning if the federal government does not, because the validation gets into the farmed cervidae side of compensation if there is a potential buyout at the federal level. So I just want your opinion on that, and maybe Representative Anderson too. I think we've got good people that we put good money into who've done good work, and the years just slip by and nothing happens at the federal level.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Hansen, I think that we're both generally on the same page. It's been challenging to watch as you and I have both, I think, agreed that you're saying today we've watched as that technology hasn't been federally approved. And, you know, the bill today doesn't address that, but it's certainly something that any of us that care about this issue are aware of and would like to see movement on. I am also hearing about an emerging technology that is more in line with a blood test, and I'm not pretending to understand all of the developing technologies or what it might be, what we might need to do to advance RTQIC, which I believe you're referring to, Mr. Chair. So I think we probably offline could have a long conversation about that, but I'm glad you mentioned it here today. More specifically, the bill before us is, I think, in line with what was earlier mentioned by my testifier, that we've created a number of options for, say, for example, hunters, right? So there are exceptions to statute prohibiting importation. And if there ever was a group of folks that are intent in protecting their own herds, but more importantly, the wild herd, it's these folks. So I wanted to start that conversation today. I know we're getting late in session, but there's still an opportunity. So here we are, and I asked for a hearing. So thank you for the question. And I believe my testifier also had a comment.
Thank you, Representative Heitzman. Representative Hansen, the difficulty in going rogue, so to speak, and just doing our own thing with live testing, it's not been approved by USDA. So if there was a positive found, they wouldn't recognize indemnifying the herd because it's not from an approved test. And that would put all of us in a world of difficulties.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand that. I just don't think they're going to do it ever. I just don't think it's ever going to happen. I think that they're captured. I don't think they're going to ever approve a test that they didn't create, even though we can show them the evidence and the peer-reviewed data over and over and over again for the high-quality science, and I just don't think they're going to do it. We've waited, and they told us it was right around the corner. Oh, just a little bit more, just a little bit more, and it never happens. So,
Madam Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, I would just say it does seem that Minnesota could utilize that technology, RTQIC, for our own use and demonstrate its accuracy, but probably the wrong committee. But a good conversation. I'm glad we're having it today here.
Representative Hansen? All right. All right, Representative Heinzman, do you have any final comments on your bill before we lay it over?
No, just thank you to the committee. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to talk about 4508. I think there's others that could also be impacted in a positive way, and maybe we'll see something happen on this. I would hope that it could be a part of a broader discussion going forward, and I'll end it there. Thank you again.
Thank you, Representative Heinzman. House File 4508 is laid over. The next item on the agenda is a presentation from the Department of Agriculture on farm safety, mental health, and farm advocates. Mr. Huginen and Ms. Moynihan, please be seated at the table and proceed with your testimony when you are ready. But please state your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Other way. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm hoping that this will pop up here. I may need to phone a friend as to why that's different than what I'm seeing. So, but I will get started. I know the presentations are in your packets. For the record, my name is Paul Huguenin. I'm the Director of the Ag Marketing and Development Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity today, first of all, to talk a little bit about our efforts related to farm safety, farm stress, and rural mental health. A note that this presentation will touch on information related to three different appropriations in the department's budget. The first, there's a $100,000 a year appropriation related to farm safety grants. It also includes the funding where we pay for the, thank you, where we play for the 24/7 crisis, first call for help crisis line. The second will be the appropriation that is a pass-through to Region 5 Development Commission that covers the ag mental health providers. And then third, the Farm Advocate Program. I'll start out by covering the farm safety portion of this, and then my colleague Meg Moynihan will cover the balance of the information. The oldest part of our farm safety program relates to rollover protection structures, often called ROPs. The state will pay 70%, reimburse farmers 70% of the cost of adding these rollover protection structures. Think of them as roll bars. The farmer's contribution is capped at $500 per tractor. To be eligible, tractors have to be built before 1987. For those who maybe haven't spent a lot of time on farms, you may be looking at that picture and saying, wait a minute, we hear all the time about how high-tech agriculture is, and we see pictures of these big tractors running on GPS, and the question may be, do farmers still use tractors like this? And the short answer is yes, absolutely. And there's a lot of reasons for it in a lot of scenarios. First of all, for specialty crop and small farmers, this is a more appropriate size and age tractor. But regardless of farm size, there are lots of uses for tractors made before 1987. Things like mowing, doing anything related to haying, moving equipment, moving wagons, light field work, et cetera. So the short answer is that these tractors are common. If you look at the activity with this program in the last 2 years, you can see pretty good participation around the state. The average state contribution to installing a ROP system is about $1,500 per tractor. We ran the numbers, and if you go back in the roughly 8 or 9 years since Chair Anderson authored the first funding bill for ROPs, this program has helped farmers install ROPs on approximately 600 tractors around the state of Minnesota. So a lot of success and a lot of participation. The second part of our farm safety program is related to the dangers of grain storage facilities. And again, you look at the picture of this, and it looks like an innocent enough structure. It doesn't look like something that is as dangerous as it is. There are all sorts of risks related to grain bins and other grain storage facilities, ranging from the danger and the risk of entrapment to internal augers that exist in the bins, stairs and ladders that are open, et cetera. With this program, we reimburse farmers 75% of the cost of installing safety equipment. There's a maximum of $400 per bin and a maximum of $2,400 per farmer for this program. Similar to the ROPs, there's good geographic distribution, there's good participation from farmers. One note is that both of these programs are they're available on a first-come, first-served basis. So we accept applications on an ongoing basis throughout the year. If a farmer is eligible, then we start the process and they can buy the equipment and we can reimburse them. The other thing I wanted to mention is that awareness of farm safety tends to ebb and flow depending on the news cycle. So when there is a tragedy and it becomes the talk of a coffee shop and local newspapers, but when there's not, it tends to fall off kind of the stream of consciousness. One of the points of emphasis that Commissioner Peterson has had is to make sure that farm safety efforts remain an ongoing priority for the agency, but also for the agricultural community at large. One of the ways that we do that is by hosting quarterly farm safety working group meetings, and those are attended by farm organizations, they're attended by Extension, safety experts at places like Department of Labor and Industry and DEED, and other interested folks. Want to make sure you know that legislators are certainly welcome to join those quarterly meetings. So if you have an interest, let us know. We'll add you to the invite list. We'd love to have you participate. With that, with your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like to transition for the rest of the information to my colleague, Meg Moynihan.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Meg Moynihan, and I serve as Senior Advisor for Strategy and Partnerships at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. It is a great pleasure to be back before this committee talking about farm stress and mental health, although those are challenging topics to cover. It is good to be back, and I do want to also say thank you to the committee staff who were part of making this happen and were very accommodating to us. There are unique and insistent combinations of stressors in agriculture, even at the best of times. And right now, the ag sector, as you are well aware, is experiencing extremely strong financial headwinds that are affecting farmers and farm family members of all ages, on all operations of all types and all scales. At the department, we approach our work to support farmers in stress with three key assumptions that we base our work on. One is that different people need different things. Some people need a mental health therapist. Some people need their family doctor. Some people need a talk with a pastor. Some people need some time with an old friend. So we do not assume to know what people need, but we know there are different things, and it is our goal to try to help people find what they need with the fewest leaps possible. They're already in stress. We try to make help as normal as possible, help seeking as normal as possible. We've learned a lot from the Department of Health and other partners in this work. But it is, and we've also actually learned from other farmers in this work who have sought help for themselves and say it is important. We don't need to keep the stiff upper lip. We all need help at some time. So we all need to pull a tractor apart at some times. You need help for that. Sometimes you need help for your brain as well. And we also acknowledge that lots already exists. We are not the only game in town. We're not necessarily even the best game in town. We are one of the games in town. We are dedicated to farmers and farm families and others involved in agriculture. That is some of what makes us unique. But we have lots of partners that we work with to make projects and programs happen. We work both cooperatively and collaboratively with more than I could even fit on this slide for you. We share ideas and resources. We share the visibility of other people, others' programs and resources. And one of the things that we're working on now, we're at the very beginning of it, is working with a number of these partners on a farm suicide prevention campaign to get messaging out, supportive messaging to farmers, because we are hearing increasing reports of farmers who are taking their own lives, have taken their own lives, or who are at risk, and people who are concerned about their friends and family members in farming. Legislative funding is essential to the things that we do for farm stress at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Mr. Huguenin referred to the pass-through funding for agricultural mental health providers. That pass-through goes to Region 5 Economic Development Commission, and we now have three counselors in place who offer services free of charge to farmers, farm family members, ag-connected people all over the state, sometimes remotely, sometimes in person, sometimes by telephone. Monica McConkie has been before this committee. She has been on board since about 2017. And with the retirement of Ted Matthews, who was the founding counselor in this program, Region 5 has contracted with two new individuals who provide support and assistance. They work half-time. And that's Jenny Vaughn at the left and Tracy Self at the right. Jenny is more northern and Tracy is more southern. Between November and March, I just got these numbers yesterday from Region 5, the three of them combined have held 564 sessions with clients. That is in addition to presenting at meetings and conferences throughout the farm meeting and conference season. They are reporting that they see a lot of clients who bring relationship problems, could be spousal relationship problems, could be two siblings in business together, farm transfer and succession pressures, anxiety. Those are the most common issues right now that are bringing clients in their doors. And they're also reporting, as I mentioned earlier, more encounters with clients who are at risk of suicide. We have a Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline that I want to mention to you. And I want to share some data from the helpline and how it has been performing. We do not answer this ourselves. We contract with the First Call for Help of Itasca County, which I think Mr. Huguenin referenced. In a contract situation and have seen increased use. Calls and texts are answered by them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on a dedicated line. So when the individual calls, they get the greeting, thank you for calling the Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline. What can we do for you? And we're getting increased use, as I said, and I think this is due in part to a few things. I think it's due to the fact that more families are experiencing farm stress. I think the stressors are growing. I think, in part, the idea of seeking help is slowly becoming more acceptable. And so people may be more willing to pick up the phone in the middle of the night or at lunchtime when they're in the house and make a call. And I also think that it's in part because each year that goes by, farmers and the farm community are more and more familiar with this program and the fact that it exists. You can't tell somebody something once and assume it will stick, particularly when it's something that they're going to need when they're maybe close to the bottom. We do a tremendous amount of outreach to promote our programs. We attend events like Farm Fest, where we hand out gun locks that are provided by the Department of Veterans Affairs and the VA. We go to places like Ag Expo, Prairie Grains Conference, Extension Women's Conference. At the Minnesota State Fair, we have developed a program that I think is particularly fun and also particularly impactful. We call it Fan Mail for Farmers. And because most of the people that we encounter at State Fair on the day that we do this, which is NAMI Minnesota's Mental Health Awareness Day, most of the people who stop by are not farmers. So we're not talking to farmers. We're talking to people who know relatively little about farmers and little about agriculture. So we talk to them about the challenges and the stresses that farmers face, whatever they are during that year. We've done this for the past 3 years. And we invite them to write a postcard that we later send to a random farmer in Minnesota. And all of those postcards start with the words, we don't tell them to do this, but they do. They start with the words, thank you. Thank you for being a farmer. Thank you for doing this work. Please stay safe this season. We give them a few little prompts, and I scan them to make sure that nothing creepy is going out, you know. So that has happened. But the people love it, and I have heard from one or two farmers who have received the postcards in the mail and thought it was not creepy, but supportive. We did this also, I have to say, at the Farm Aid 40 festival that happened in Minneapolis this fall, and so had broader exposure to people from even more states who I'm hoping will be taking our ideas back to their states. The long list of partners that I shared with you in slide two is really critical to helping us distribute promotional materials which build awareness for the programs and services that we offer. This includes brochures in four languages that cover our programs. I believe you have one in your packet. They cover our programs from the department, but also a number of our partners' programs. So it's a one-stop brochure, carefully cultivated. We do chip clips, we do can koozies, we do wallet cards. Farm Bureau has just come out with some amazing stickers saying, what do they say? They say, caution, a healthy farm is nothing without you. And they include the 988 Suicide and Crisis Line, the national line, and also our Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline. So we will be helping Farm Bureau distribute those. The items are important because I think the more you see these, the more the services become a little normal. You become used to them. And we want to have them on everybody's dashboard or clipped to everybody's fuel barrel or out in the shop with a can of pop in it so that when they encounter somebody who needs the number, who might be themselves, that number is right there. I do want to say that we would be happy to provide any of these items to you or your staff if you want to take them out into the community or if you'd like to have them available at your home offices. We also have drop-in graphics if any of you have newsletters. We're happy to do that as well. At this point, I'd like to move on to our Farm Advocate Program, and I have to say the manager of this program is Matt McDevitt with the Rural Finance Authority. He supervises this program. He was not available to attend, so I've been entrusted with this part of the presentation. This is a program that started way back in 1984 as an outcome of the farm crisis that seized the entire nation. And many states created programs like this. Most of them let them slide. Minnesota has continued to support this for farmers and recognizing this need. We use contract providers, individual contract providers, and they provide services at no fees to producers. They are extremely scrupulous about confidentiality because many of these conversations are about financial issues. And that is very, very private information to a producer. Their role is to provide one-on-one confidential assistance to farmers who are facing crises that are caused either by financial problems or by natural disasters. So that is their charge. And they understand the needs of agricultural families and communities. Most of them are either retired producers themselves or our retired farm business management instructors who have a wealth and depth of information. They are, you can see their expertise up on the screen, everything from lending practices to sensing when a client might need referral to one of the ag mental health providers, to farm programs and recognizing the need for legal and social services. Sometimes somebody needs an attorney and that's not something that our advocates can do, but they can encourage a farmer to pursue that and help them find somebody that's going to work for them. They come with this expertise, but we also do ongoing professional development for them. And here are the 12 farm advocates, and you can see their location around the state. We have 12 now, and that is a kind of a full complement for the demand that we're dealing with. Two recent additions are Laura Cullip and Friendly Vang Johnson. They specialize in small farms, specialty crop farms, and they also have some special language skills. Laura is fluent in Spanish, and Friendly is fluent in Hmong. So we're able to provide direct services without the use of a translator in those two languages. Rhonda Verkstein actually is the last one that we brought on board from up in Thief River Falls in so we're glad to have him with us. The demand is high. The advocates spent 6,223 hours with clients last fiscal year, and they're up to over 4,000 year to date for the first 7 months of this year. What they're hearing from, what people are calling about are, I need help with mediation. I had a mediation letter. I got a mediation packet. I need help. How do I prepare for this? Will you go with me to this? And the answer to that is yes. The motto of the farm advocates are, we are in the farmer's corner. They are hearing more about concerns regarding bankruptcy and that bankruptcy is on the horizon. They are hearing about farm transition. This is coming up as a theme over and over again in this presentation, but farm transition and succession assistance are on the minds of a great many of our farmers who are approaching retirement age, and the decision about what is going to happen to the farm is not easy financially, legally, or emotionally. So they deal with a lot of that. And they also help farmers with financials when they're looking for operating loans. So that is something that right now they are very busy with and taking calls from farmers who are desperate to find money to put their crop in. The Farm Advocate brochure has a long list of advice to people on when should you see a farm advocate. And it's everything from, as I said, mediation to lenders to needing information, accounts. We include this because the farm advocates are adamant that it's a lot easier to help a farmer solve his or her problem early than when it becomes a crisis. So they would really love people to come in the door when they feel something may be brewing on the horizon and they can help the producer get ahead of that. But I want to point out to you that one of the counsels that we give is you can contact a farm advocate when you want to begin farming. And so for all of the soberness of the topic that we're talking about today, farm stress, farm mental health, risk of suicide, we have optimism in agriculture. We have young people and middle-aged people who are starting farms. I just pre-reviewed a set of proposals for the Beginning Farmer Equipment Grant, and the grant manager said we had 550 applications from qualified beginning farmers in Minnesota. So there is great optimism. And there are some people for whom optimism may be slipping away a little bit. And we want to be in a position at the Department of Agriculture to provide the sources and support that those producers need to keep agriculture full and vibrant. That concludes my remarks, and I believe Mr. Huguenin's remarks. And Madam Chair, if there are questions, we'd be happy to entertain those.
Thank you for that presentation. Are there any questions from members? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that you said was that you may not be the best game in town, but you were a game in town. Just for the committee's knowledge, that I was with both of these two last night, where Ms. Moynihan was awarded Advocate of the Year by the Center for Rural Behavioral Health. And I just wanted to acknowledge her work and thank her at the same time. That's all.
Congratulations.
Madam Chair. Representative Frederick's Oshucks, thank you.
All right, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and congratulations again, Ms. Moynihan. We've had these discussions over the years. There sometimes is a high suicide rate on tribal reservations and then also with first responders. Does the helpline provide, and do you provide services in rural areas to tribal members or first responders who may be in the rural areas?
Ms. Moynihan?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, the helpline answers and helps anybody who calls. While we market this as the Minnesota Farm and Rural Helpline, sometimes calls come in from other states. They certainly are not going to turn anybody away. They are more familiar with the resources regarding agriculture. The first call for help of Itasca, which is the contractor that we use, also has contracts with tribal communities and with other organizations around the state to answer their calls. So we are by no means their only client. They have dedicated lines that come in. So the short answer to your call is we don't specifically reach out to those communities, but their calls are being answered.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the department, thank you for the work you do. All of you folks, you do your work well, you care about people, and we really appreciate that. Madam Chair, if I could, I had a question, and it kind of relates to lending or farm borrowing. If anybody could answer a question on the RFA that's in the audience, Commissioner. During the Easter recess, I think three counties in Minnesota, including my home county of Pope County, were declared federal disaster areas. And I stopped into the FSA office on Monday to just ask what that all entailed, being a disaster area. And they said that on the federal side, a person who would apply, and it was only a loan program for federal money, but being it was involved with the RFA on the state level, they had said that the only farmers who would qualify for this federal loan program would have to be turned down by their own local bank. Is that the same with the state qualifications as well for RFA loans?
Commissioner Peterson, welcome.
Madam Chair and Chair Anderson, I don't believe so. What happened, and it's so frustrating sometimes because at Central Minnesota, you know, your area, Renville County, Candiota County got hit so hard, but it was just certain areas of it, you know, and we've been waiting for these declarations. They take a long time. They come from the federal government. And unfortunately, what it really, offers is loans, you know, and they come with caveats, you know. And so the one thing I just say mention too is once you're in a disaster area, a lot of times they come back when we have a wildfires in Hawaii or earthquakes or things, that they do an ad hoc disaster program. A lot of those times those folks will be eligible for some kind of payment though too. But to your point, for the RFA, once the USDA declares declares a disaster, those counties are eligible for our disaster recovery loan, which has a 0% interest rate. And checking with Mr. McDevitt, who's not here today, so I don't want to speak out of case, he said, yes, that declaration opens up those folks in those counties to work with our Rural Finance Authority. And again, the RFA takes 45% of the loan at a 0%, but it partners with a local bank. So you have to have a local bank partner that takes 55% of the loan, and then they you know, can charge whatever interest rate they want. But it is really important. We have been waiting, have farmers that have been waiting for that, that could really use the money right now. So I don't know if that totally answers your question, but that's kind of what I understand or know right now.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Peterson, since you're there. I have a question, and it follows up. You know, I just was getting a text, the Strait of Hormuz is closed again. You know, we've lived in very disruptive times for the last year, and we continue to do that, and we have these programs that we've established years ago that try to help people, whether they're farmers or rural members or not. But we also provide exceptions, and sometimes money flows like water, flows downhill and it flows through the exceptions and flows through the holes. You know, and today I saw that we have churches buying up land. You know, I've heard for years about, you know, it's Pheasants Forever that's buying up land, or it's, you know, we have a strong corporate farm law, but money's powerful, particularly when there's a lot of it. And so I just like your thoughts on that, because we may be trying to patch up things here, programs that we've had for years, but when there's massive money coming in relating to land, access to land is the issue, I believe. Mm-hmm. Access to land is the issue. How do you get land if you want to start farming or keep farming?
Commissioner Peterson.
Madam Chair and Chair Hansen, a few thoughts there. First, I just say, you know, I really appreciate the opportunity to have this hearing today, you know, and remind all of you that, you know, you get calls from farmers that have a hard time. And remember the, you know, to refer people to the hotline, really the advocates is a great free and confidential, you know, again, been around since the 80s. You know, I started out then. Know what it was like, and it is so important to have those, you know, resources. To me, the difference in the struggles we're having right now, and you can see the mediation notices, you can see the calls to the hotline, you know, we know there's people struggling, is the land prices have not took a dive like they did in the 80s, you know. And so there's a lot to that. The land prices are holding up, and what you're referencing is something that, you know, the department is looking at or working on. Representative Burkles asked me about this too, as purchases by the Church of Latter-day Saints, you know, and what they're not using necessarily a religious exemption, but it's a nonprofit exemption within the corporate farm law that we're, you know, looking at as a department and how that works. And, you know, we'll have more information, you know, soon on that, but we're, you know, working on it. I'm actually meeting with them tomorrow because I do have concerns about the amount of land that they are purchasing, not just in Minnesota, but the upper Midwest. So as we look at pressures, it's already hard enough to buy and purchase land, you know, when you have, you know, other entities or folks purchasing that does become a concern. But I'll try to keep the committee updated as that moves on, because I know some of you have been, you know, contacted about that.
Representative Hansen. All right. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and really appreciate, just want to say, echo what my colleagues have said. Thank you to the agency and your staff for this. Just looking at the ROTS program, can you guys provide us, after the committee, a 10-year look back to where the the funding have gone to. Really appreciate seeing that, at least on the map. It seems like for 24, 25, three of them were in the Seminole County metro area. Just appreciate knowing, you know, over the last 10 years where that have went. Thank you.
Who had the answer to that question?
I would. Madam Chair, Representative Lee, we'd be happy to do that. We could put together a 10-year map and show you exactly where those are and pull out perhaps the Seven County Metro. But thanks for the question.
Representative Lee, anything further? No? All right. Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to be cognizant of time, I guess this would also be a request to get back to us later. I'm just curious about some of the feedback that you were hearing from farmers that are specifically struggling with that transition decision. You know, obviously there's a lot of different factors that you know, play into that decision to transition out of farming and pass it on to somebody else. But, you know, we have found, we talked about, you know, consolidation in previous committees as well as this one, is that is sometimes an avenue where consolidation occurs, is if somebody isn't able to inherit the family farm or something like that. And so be interested in looking at potential solutions, first by identifying the pressure points that we, from a policy perspective, that exist within that transition process, seeing if there's anything that we can do as a legislature to address those. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Anyone want to answer that thought, or?
Madam Chair and Representative Gottfried, we would be very happy to do that. And we have a member of our staff, well, Paul's staff, at the department, Jim Ostley, who runs our Farm Link program. And a lot of what he does is in the service of transition and succession. We do also some collaboration with Extension and with Minnesota State System on that. And so we'd be happy to continue that conversation and get you more information. Thank you.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. And, you know, in addition to Minnesota, I feel has, like, you know, when I go to my national meetings, you know, we have, I think, the strongest suite of programs to help transfer the farm to the next generation. We have the Beginning Farmer Tax Credit, put a plug in that funding is, you know, we have way more people that use that than we have money for at the time. But we have that credit. It's extremely effective. We have the Down Payment Assistance Program that, you know, has helped over 100 new farms get it. No other state has that. We also have the Rural Finance Authority has a beginning farmer loan that helps those beginning farmers start. That's our number one loan that we have. We also have a bill to put more money into the RFA. I'll make a pitch for that. But we have that suite of programs in Minnesota, as well as FarmLink, as well as Emerging Farmers Office, that helps, you know, try to recognize that need. And I appreciate the support that we've had from the legislature to get that up and running.
Representative Godfrey. All right. And our final question comes from Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess we're going to get to our adjournment time anyway. But just as we're talking about farm transitioning, you know, it's a difficult topic. And there was a bill introduced, or a bill heard, I believe, in the tax committee this week that had to do with taxing unrealized capital gains. And in terms of agricultural land, that would be disastrous. We're already talking about farmers being, you know, cash poor, and then to levy a tax on an unrealized capital gain that you would have no benefit on until you sell it. I mean, that would be a difficult thing for farmers who are facing cash problems, cash flow problems, and talking about the transition piece, it would be very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Well, thank you so much for your presentation. I appreciate all the information today. The next meeting is Monday, April 13th, and Chair Hansen will have the gavel. There being no further business before us, this meeting is adjourned.